And yes, this is the Mideast Migraine Show for Monday, February 8th. Wait a minute. No, 9. Yeah. February 9, 2015. Just in case there was an earlier introduction before this beautiful Egyptian music started up here. This is the Monday, February 9 show. Of Mideast Migraines on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Broadcasting at 101.3 FM. Despite what you may have seen on earlier t-shirts and very old ads, you can forget any other frequencies that you may have associated with us. They are long gone. We are broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial, and we, of course, we're streaming live at freakradio.org. That is freakradio.org. My name's Ren Tawil, your friendly local neighborhood Palestinian American. And on Mideast Migraines, we explore a narrative that presented in a way that is virtually never heard on mainstream media. Being a pal am, of course, I'm going to say things that will upset, disturb, or otherwise generate even mild contempt from many who are used to hearing the Israeli narrative about events in Palestine, Israel. I've dedicated myself to this task, and this show has been going on for, close to 2.5 years, and over 2.5 years. Began in the middle of the late spring, I believe, of 2012. Okay, let's get into today's reading. Got some really fascinating articles for you to behold. This just came over the wire to me yesterday. It's from Haaretz, which is, of course, the leading news and cultural periodical from the state of Israel itself. Israel's official religion is not Judaism, it's the Holocaust. That's what it is. And until I get a decent page here to read from you, let's have a little more Egyptian music. Actually, this is not strictly Egyptian. This is a different album now from Azza, Santa Cruz's very own Azza.
Thank you.
Okay, folks. Actually, I did have the entire article in front of me a moment ago, but I always like to read directly from the source material itself. Again, this is from Haaretz, from Israel. And admittedly, there are a number of Jewish Israelis who don't care for Haaretz, wondering out loud whether or not they're Haaretz is allied with terrorists. Mind you, this is a strictly Israeli publication, both Hebrew and English editions available. I do not know if Haaretz is available in Arabic, but there are a lot of Israeli Jews who are angry at Haaretz and hate them because they print such, well, face it, leftist stuff. In this case, leftist to be interpreted as pro-Arab, pro-Palestinian. And many Israelis do not make a distinction between being Palestinian and being a terrorist. So, again, this is dated February 8, yesterday, by Benny Ziffer. Israel's official religion is not Judaism, it's the Holocaust. My, my. Again, authored by Benny Ziffer. Contrary to what people think, the official religion of Israel is not the Jewish religion. Israel is certainly the state of the Jewish people, but its dominant religion is the religion of the Holocaust. It's a full-scale religion with its own rituals and holidays, numberless martyrs, and a central pilgrimage site, namely Auschwitz. And I believe that would be in the country of Poland, Auschwitz, Poland, present-day Poland. Above all, as befits an established religion, it has its heretics and those who have not yet seen the light and need to be converted. The heretics are not necessarily those who deny the Holocaust. Those transgressors are subject to the punishments prescribed in the law. The heretics might be families and ordinary people living among us who, when the siren on Israel's Holocaust Day blares, make it a point not to stand to attention. Still, their heresy bothers them, and they shout angrily that they don't feel like standing at attention in memory of the Ashkenazim who perished, and that their suffering too, that is, of the Mizrahim, the Jews from Arab lands, should also be commemorated. All this is portrayed in the subversive and terrifically witty episode that opens the second season of the fine television comedy drama series Zaguri Empire, created by Maor Zaguri, a talented young screenwriter and director from Be'er Sheva. In the first season, we learned about the falafel stand that the Zaguri family inherited from the mother's father and about how they were not enthusiastic about continuing to run the business. In the second season's opener, we see the family sitting with sour faces, sourest of all is the elderly grandmother, in the living room opposite the television, which is turned off, as this is the eve of Holocaust Day, and all the regular broadcasts are preempted. But contrary to what we might expect, this is not your usual scene of Moroccan folklore, which derides the, quote, primitiveness, or the supposedly tempestuous and irascible temperament of that ethnic group's members. What we have is a completely normal family, and parenthetically, there are tensions between its members, but that only adds to the normality, that feels that it has to protect itself in the face of some sort of external oppression, whose coerciveness it objects to and tries to break free of, though without noticeable success. That oppression is the Holocaust, more precisely, the need to feel automatic solidarity with believers in what can be called the religion of the Holocaust. I watch this family as its head, superbly played by Moshe Ivgi, utters perfectly valid arguments against Holocaust Day and pours out his wrath on the way the state ignores his family's suffering. Some of his members had perished on the Egos, a ship of illegal immigrants from Morocco, which sank in 1961. Well, I said to myself, something good is happening in Israeli culture. At last, people are daring to say that one of the basic rights of human beings is to be normal and not be haunted by the nightmares of the past. Naturally, an argument immediately breaks out between the father and two of his children, who represent young Mizrahim, Arab Jews, who want to assimilate into the Israeli culture and take upon themselves the yoke of the precepts of the religion of the Holocaust. They don't feel comfortable with their, quote, primitive family. At the same time, they assail their father, who is demonstratively demonstratively disdaining Holocaust Day and paints them as unimaginative conformist conservatives. And the father, along with the mother and the grandmother, come across as original thinkers, as rebels who are young in spirit. It follows that this is not a Mizrahi series. In it, Maor Zaguri has followed, perhaps unknowingly, the path of the late Shulamit Aloni, who tried years ago in vain to put an end to the organized trips to Auschwitz by high school students. It's amazing, though, in that Zaguri is also following in the footsteps of an old movement that faded away but apparently never died, the mid-20th century movement of young Hebrews known as the Canaanites, whose angry leader, poet Yonatan Ratush, urged that we Israelis cut ourselves off from the exilic mentality, and from Jewishness, and establish a new identity here of a local Hebrew pagan character. His dream is realized to some degree in Zaguri Empire, the TV series, and perhaps also in the segment of Israeli reality that the series seeks to represent. For the Zaguri family are indeed pagans. We needn't make the mistake of thinking that just because this is a traditionalist family in which the father attends synagogue and recites the blessing over the challah on Sabbath Eve, it is not a pagan family. It is pagan in the sense of not accepting the religion of the Holocaust, or of accepting it only in part and not seriously. And by the way, the father and the mother decide that next year they will stand to attention during the siren alternately, he for half a minute and she for half a minute. Again, folks, I am reading from the Haaretz article from February 5, entitled Israel's Official Religion is Not Judaism, It's the Holocaust. The family portrayed in the daring TV comedy drama series Zaguri Empire doesn't believe in coerced sadness on Holocaust Day. By Benny Ziffer. Continuing now. If there are, in reality, many families like the one depicted in this series, then we are in good shape, even very good shape, for it is impossible not to arrive at the conclusion that there has been a failure in all the efforts made by the state and the hegemonic culture to imbue Israelis with the depressive diaspora seriousness that is personified in the Holocaust Day ceremonies and in the organized school trips to Auschwitz. The reason the efforts have failed is that even if many Israelis continue to observe these customs out of habit, deep inside themselves they know instinctively that the Holocaust has become a means of control and coercion, something that deprives them of their freedom. Not only because they're not allowed to watch the regular TV programs on that day, on the day it is commemorated, but also because they feel that the Holocaust acts as a kind of wall That excludes all those who did not receive a Holocaust lineage certificate and turns them into a kind of sect of the impure. That's the whole article. Now, until I give the telephone lines out so that you may respond to it, let's read some of the internet article reader comments. Pete says, "This headline is a particularly disgusting one, even by Haaretz standards. Hey, journalists, in quotes, is there anything you would not do for generating clicks on your site?" Not a happy camper there. Shimon says, "Entirely correct. All can worship. No belief in Sky Fairy needed. But about that God-given right to the land, got that wrong anyway," Shimon says. La Vie in Seattle. "The Holocaust was just one of many satanically inspired attempts in his story slash history to eradicate the Jewish people and thus usurp God's unfolding plan of salvation for mankind. The Holocaust is certainly not Israel's official religion, but rather this is more her acknowledgement of the everlasting covenant, the Holy One of Israel, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has with his people." And incidentally, Lavi spells God in the traditional contemporary English-speaking Jewish way of capital D dash D. I'm sorry, capital G dash D. G dash D. This is because it is considered historical, according to ancient Hebrew scripture, that it is forbidden to actually say the whole name of God. In fact, it is kind of an effrontery to even make the utterance of God's name, as I understand it. Okay, Yaakov pipes in with, if I can, okay. "True. How many books have been written about the other 50 millions of victims during World War II? I wonder how much that sentiment is on the minds of Israeli Jews. Daniel Campo says, "Zaguri Empire is racist. That's all." And then, oh, wait a minute. Unless, of course, oh no, there's more. Just forgot to click. "Zaguri Empire is racist. It portrays Mizrahim and Sephardic Jews in the worst possible way. It makes them look as vulgar people with a culture of hate and superstition. If you take sex, vulgar language, and violence out of this show, you are left with nothing." Interesting. Oh, I'd love to see an episode of that Zaguri Empire. By the way, we've already established Mizrahim is the Jewish or Hebrew pronunciation of the Jews who come into Israel from the various Arab countries in the Middle East, because there have been many Jews who lived for a very, very long time, a few million of them, in fact, in the Arab countries. Sadly, they were compelled to leave a few years after Israel, the State of Israel, became established in 1948. The fact that that this happened and they were ostracized from society and pretty much given no choice but to leave, I have always maintained is one of the biggest mistakes that the Arabs made, both the Arab people and their respective governments, in dealing with Israel and dealing with the Jews, on two counts. Number one, those Jewish people did, as I say, have their lineage going back hundreds or ultimately thousands of years, throughout the Middle East, and those were their homes. But it was also a mistake in the sense that it depending on the way you look at it, this expulsion backfired because it bolstered the Jewish population of Israel, which contributed to the supplantation or the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinian Arabs who were not Jewish, who lived there to begin with. So it's a pretty stupid thing. So those were the Mizrahim. Now the Sephardic Jews, and this is interesting, I was familiar with the word Sephardic or Sephardim before I ever heard of Mizrahim. A few decades ago, I heard Sephardim applied to Arab Jews in the same way that Mizrahim is. The only thing is, Sephardic, as I recall, originally referred to the Jews who lived amongst the Moors in present-day Morocco and Spain when the Islamic Empire at a certain stage of history spilled over into the far western corner, southwestern corner of Europe. And the Sephardim are supposed to be Jews, the Jews who lived among them. Interestingly, Sephardim began to be applied, probably by the dictates of the Israeli government or its educational branches, to all Arab Jews, no matter which Arab country they came from. This was a source of some confusion for me, and obviously is still a little confusing, but I talked with a Jewish friend of mine back in Minnesota about this, and she agreed, yes, her reply to me was basically, there is a reluctance to admit that one could be an Arab and a Jew at the same time. Okay, and finally I'll read this comment to the internet article. This is not a serious article. The issue of the Holocaust allows for such a point of view, but not in the way that this is written. The Holocaust has overshadowed our capacity to live as Jews, both in Israel and in the diaspora. We tend to substitute a Jewish life, not necessarily religious, for ceremonies and rituals dealing with the Shoah. Shoah is the Hebrew word for Holocaust, for the Holocaust during the Second World War, before and during the war. The issue is much deeper and complex and affects all Jews, not only those without a, quote, Holocaust past, as this article suggests. It is a pity such a delicate and complex subject wasn't treated in a more serious manner. Okay, well, to begin with, the article was not very long, so I don't, at least in terms of length, I don't think that particular complainer has much to complain about. Then again, it's refreshing for me to hear a general review of an Israeli television show, primetime, I assume, primetime television show. Okay, well, let me give you those phone numbers here. Again, you are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM and streaming live at freakradio.org. Remember, if you're listening to us on radio right now or to a selected item from my archives or a refeed of this program, if you're listening to it on radio, traditional radio set, remember that you can listen to our stream at freakradio.org. That's Freak as in freakradio.org. Just make sure you click on the listen link and follow the instructions carefully so that you may receive the free streaming link. The area code for both phone numbers is 831. That's in Santa Cruz County, California. Area code 831. Line 1 is 427-3772. 427-3772. Line 2, same area code. 469-3119. Again, line 2 is 469-3119. Give us a call here. I don't care how long you've been listening to this show, even if this is your first time. think of it as a kind of check-in. Because check-in with me that there is an audience out there. I know for a fact there are a few of you. This is free radio. And amongst the scores and scores of free radio services across the nation, across the continent, if anything, aside from our free radio-nesses and our liberalness, leftiness, it's probably also known that we don't have a hell of a lot of listeners, because we do not have the resources, for bragging about our services. We can sell a few T-shirts, hand out some flyers, and just generally get the word out. I suspect that the best weapon that we have for PR purposes is word of mouth. So tell your friends and enemies, tell your family, even the ones you might not have been talking to for years, tell them about Free Radio Santa Cruz. We are definitely alive and living. Next month is our 20th anniversary, by the way. More on that later. More on the great celebration. Great celebration that we're still working the details out of. More on that later on. And let's see here. Put this aside. Move on down the line here. Let's try this one from fellow free radio programmer Donna, our very own Donna. Let's see. Now, this is from an outlet apparently called 6 Minutes to Palestine. 6 Minutes to Palestine. Sounds like a blog, but it looks like it's a little more formality to it than just being a blog. Israel's historical fear of the Palestinian mind, witnessed in Gaza today, also February 8, by Sami Kishawi. Israel's historical fear of the Palestinian mind, witnessed in Gaza today. And remember, folks, you can call in at any time. Don't worry about interrupting me. Although I am the only one here in the studio at the moment. Don't worry about me not being available to answer your call. I will pick up as soon as the lights are a-flashing and the bells are ringing. Okay, once more, Israel's historical fear of the Palestinian mind, witnessed in Gaza today, by Sami Kishawi. In the Gaza Strip, the ongoing siege has ruined the lives of tens of thousands of families and has effectively crushed the dreams of so many bright Palestinian students. The siege was created in 2006 to deprive Palestinians not just of food, water, and daily use products, but of safety, opportunity, and a window to the outside world as well. This weekend, students unable to leave Gaza to pursue further education staged a protest and threw mock diplomas into the sea as a symbol of their achingly lost dreams. Israel has historically feared the Palestinian mind. The exaggerated stories of Palestinian parents walking miles over rocks and in between tanks, barefoot and carrying recycled notebooks, bearing the scuffed graphite strokes of last year's notes, are truer than we are inclined to believe. Education is emphasized and then it is overemphasized. Palestinians allow very little to get in the way of education, and it is not uncommon for families to send their children to school, even with Israeli airstrikes ringing just miles away. Hours-long delays at military checkpoints are factored into the travel time. Palestinians don't arrive to class late. They leave home early. Despite its challenging circumstances, Palestine is recognized throughout the Middle East for its academic achievement. Literacy rates are among the highest in the Middle East. Education, many Palestinians will say, is one of Palestine's most sacred institutions. A large part of the emphasis on education comes out of necessity. During the Nakba, Arabic word for the catastrophe experienced by the 750,000 Palestinians and the roughly 2,000 of them who died in the creation of Israel, the 750,000 who were forced to flee and remain refugees to this day. During the Nakba, Israeli paramilitary troops raiding Palestinian homes confiscated tons of Palestinian property, including books and important documents. Most of the books were never to be opened again. In the decades following the looting, thousands were given away. Thousands were destroyed for, quote, threatening the state. And thousands were hidden away in the warehouse of a government library where they were later recategorized as abandoned property to erase any connection between the texts and their rightful owners. One of the researchers involved in these findings characterized this as a cultural massacre. Israel's ongoing appropriation and deliberate destruction of Palestinian history, culture, and infrastructure has turned the very essence of education into one of the Palestinian people's most effective forms of resistance. History's being re-recorded. Theories are being redefined. Resourcefulness is paying off in the form of novel applications and technologies, such as the seeing cane for the blind. And most importantly, families with virtually nothing left are still determined to send their children to school. Education's prominent role in Palestinian tradition extends to the diaspora as well, where students are growing more and more conscious of their privileged access to schools and resources. Although no statistics are currently available, it would not be surprising to see that a record number of Palestinians are enrolled in higher education and in graduate programs. To add on to that, students and educators are increasingly returning home to share their knowledge and to learn from what Palestinians on the ground have created, both intellectually and creativity. The education infrastructure in the occupied Palestinian territories is undoubtedly damaged. In only the last 8 years, dozens of schools and university buildings in the Gaza Strip have been destroyed beyond repair as a result of Israeli invasions. Only the last 8 years. Thousands of Palestinians in Jerusalem have no classrooms. Israeli military curfews and arbitrary road and zone closures have impacted the ability of over 1,000 Palestinian schools to cater to their students. Resources aren't available. Technology is old or entirely non-existent. There are not enough social workers to combat the growing incidence of PTSD in Palestinian youth. PTSD. Post-traumatic stress disorder in Palestinian youth. Not enough social workers to combat that growing problem. Deep government regulation of public schools Deep government regulation of public schools have alienated a significant number of students and their families, and so many Palestinian students have been killed. So many seats are empty. Classrooms are dark with despair, and no matter how hard the instructor tries to shift focus to the class material, those empty seats cannot be filled, and those students cannot forget their absent peers' faces. Education in Palestine is by all means a fleeting gift. Israel's siege is constructed to make these challenges as insurmountable as possible and to interfere with Palestinian efforts to educate themselves. One of the most striking examples occurs daily at the border between Egypt and the Gaza Strip. Egypt maintains control of the Rafah border crossing and elects to keep it closed for months. Virtually nobody gets in or out. Hundreds of Palestinian students abandon their plans to attend schools outside of the Gaza Strip, where the prospects are appreciably brighter because of these closed borders. At face value, this seems as though Egypt is responsible for this obscene and inhumane closure of the border. To a very large extent, it is. But Israel is not unaccountable. Agreements made between the governments for, quote, security purposes, determine the status of the Rafah crossing's gates. Entire months go by without the border opening. And on the rare occasion that it does, strict rules limit who gets to travel through. Students, despite evidence of school enrollment dates, are frequently considered to be traveling for personal reasons rather than for educational reasons, and so their appeals to cross are largely ignored. In Gaza today, a group of stranded students staged a protest at the sea to mark their frustration. These students were forced to abandon their dreams, to attempt to forget their college acceptances, and to reconcile their disappointments at no longer being able to pursue the kind of education they worked so hard to prepare for. At that, Israel and the complicit Egyptian government might consider this a victory in the name of smashing Palestine's devotion to education. But if there's one thing for certain, these students will try again and again and again, and in the meantime, they will be gathering knowledge, nourishing their ideas, and building new dreams. End of article, entitled Israel's Historical Fear of the Palestinian Mind Witnessed in Gaza Today. As was mentioned in the article, it goes back at least as far as 1948. There is a darkly beautiful picture here of sunset, or perhaps sunrise, at sea, the Mediterranean Sea, and the caption reads, Israel's occupation is deliberate and intentionally extensive. It is designed to inflict maximum damage on Palestinians while shirking as much responsibility as possible. I think I might have read that in the course of the article. Oh, just a note here. What the hell am I talking about when I'm talking about Israeli responsibility for Palestinians? Well, my friends, I'll tell you, it goes farther than the most basic immediate concern of Israel being accountable for what it does to those under their military occupation. Admitting what they've done, admitting what the real current circumstances are, not circumventing it and no longer trying to cover up everything by deflecting their crimes with the oh-so-wonderful wonders of the State of Israel and what it's supposedly doing for everyone, whether they're Jewish or they're not Jewish. This also extends to the fact, it's a reflection of the fact that according to the good old United Nations and other international agreements, this is supposed to apply for everyone, every nation, every controlling governmental power. The rules say that a conquering nation or a nation exercising military control over another nation or another area, perhaps of a neighboring country. In this case, the West Bank, more recently being under the control of Jordan, being a part of Jordan, and Gaza being a part of Egypt up until 1967. This is what is meant by military occupation. Those areas, West Bank and Gaza, and even East Jerusalem, to the fullest extent, have not been completely or legally absorbed into the Israeli state. Israel, a few decades ago, officially annexed East Jerusalem, but of course that annexation is not recognized by the world in large. But staying on this topic of UN and other international agreement dictates, I should finish the sentence, the controlling power of those areas like the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem are obliged under law, by international agreement to provide for those people who are under occupation to make sure that they have their minimal needs for survival in terms of nutrition, medical care, education, and a degree of free access in terms of travel, particularly to and from, say, two adjacent or even not immediately adjacent areas in the occupied territory. That should remain unfettered, and certainly along with food, medicine, etc., there should at least be some ability for the people there to thrive and to exercise their own local economies. This is supposed to be true for any people under any occupation anywhere in the world. The controlling state must exercise responsibility for those people under their control. And by and large, Israel has done the exact opposite. They keep taking and taking more and more land, impinging the Palestinians, especially their ability to travel to and from the areas that are, and I put in quotes here, under their control, as in the Palestinian Authority. Not a whole lot of actual autonomous control there by any means. The PA, the Palestinian Authority, has quite accurately been referred to in recent times as an occupation management tool of Israel. That's what it is. Little more than that. And what happens to the PA when they appeal to the International Criminal Court for them, Palestine, to be a recognized member and to bring grievances to that court? Both Israel and the United States impose sanctions on the Palestinian people, on the PA. They impose sanctions, or they simply stop delivering or prevent the delivery of humanitarian and financial aid for the PA. Because the PA is looking out for itself and its own people, they're being punished. Israel prevents a viable, contiguous, democratic state of Palestine from existing, throws all kinds of roadblocks in its way. And yes, I do blame Israel for that on many counts. And when the Palestinians try to make up for that loss, for that imposed inability to be a state, they are punished. So, let's see, I came in with my little bit of expounding on that. Based on the sentence that I said here a moment ago, Israel's occupation is to inflict maximum damage on Palestinians while shirking as much responsibility as possible. That's what we mean by Israel's responsibility for the Palestinians. Not just feeding a bunch of low-life Palestinian Arabs with their hands out, but allowing them to thrive within their own economy and to make a life for themselves, including education and access to education. I see an interesting link here, folks. A link. This is another article in 16 Minutes to Palestine. We'll have a musical break here shortly. Let me give the phone numbers out again. Area code 831. Line 2 is 427-3772. 427-3772. Line 2, 469-3119. Line 2 is 469-3119. And that 831 area code is out here in Santa Cruz County on the left coast of North America. Whether you've heard this show before or not, whether you've called in or not, I would love to hear from you. More on that in a moment. Let's get this article out of the way. Also in 16 Minutes to Palestine. And also written by Sami Kishawi. A little earlier, February 5. Call out. The call out seeking submissions on the, quote, identity shaming of Palestinians. 16 Minutes to Palestine, SMP, is preparing to launch a new series on the many ways in which Palestinian Americans have had to hide their identities in academic or professional settings. There are many instances when Palestinians have been encouraged to keep their identities hidden. Encouraged to keep them hidden to avoid offending colleagues or peers, or to avoid hurting their career, academic, or personal prospects. The implication is that being Palestinian is inappropriate and that its rich and complex heritage is inherently offensive. This is largely due to the way Palestinians are vilified in mainstream news and pop culture. There are, however, many other reasons, and this is where you come in. Little has been written about this issue and its implications on Palestinian academic and professional progress. Little is also understood about what contributes to this identity shaming. Our goal is to highlight how extensively Palestinians are shamed for their identity. After that, we hope to expand the conversation into possible solutions. And just checking the old board here, I am alone in the studio. Can only accomplish so much. A little bit of time there is, okay. Continuing now. We are currently in need of guest contributors. If you have ever experienced some kind of identity shaming, if you have ever been advised to hide your identity as a Palestinian in order to, quote, better your chances, or if you have ever been punished because of your Palestinian identity, we humbly request that you consider submitting. We are looking for personal and reflective pieces on these experiences. Submissions must be at least 600 words long. This is your narrative, so write it the way you feel it should be read and understood. Your writing will also serve as documentation of the resilience and thoughtfulness of Palestinians in the diaspora. That, of course, being the non-Jewish Palestinian diaspora. For all we know, that includes some Palestinian Jews. The so-called Mizrahim. The deadline for submissions is March 4. Of this year. Please send it via Facebook message or via email. Email to this address, smpalestine@gmail.com. Of course, SM meaning 16 minutes, as in 16 minutes to Palestine. Again, the address is smpalestine@gmail.com. We will send a confirmation to alert you that we have received the piece. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, please reach out to us. Finally, please share this call out to anyone you know who might be interested in contributing. We will keep you posted with more details as this project shapes up. Thank you for reading us. I'm glad I decided to read that. It certainly made me more aware. Okay. How about that musical break, folks? Again, this is from the, 2003 album by Aza, A-Z-A. The group is called Aza. The album is Marikan. Marikan, which I believe simply is the Arabic pronunciation of American. Aza is a Middle Eastern fusion group with a notable degree of Moroccan musical influences. Let me see. Cut 7 is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Cut 7 is entitled Tamkhart. Tamkhart.
Ah! سولي كمي ولا كمت برا سولي كمي ولا كمت برا تيوي تاخد الهم يكاد انت فلا غرد وكنت اللات فلا زرينا تيوي تاخد الهم يكاد انت فلا غرد وكنت اللات فلا زرينا اطنن صافي زرينا اطنن صافي زرينا غطنن صافي زرينا لما شور وفيق ما نور توفيق كميني رواسا مدلولا
Is Akarid. I sure wish my Arabic were better, so I can tell you what those mean. Folks, before I begin the second half, as it were, of the program, this is the Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio Santa Cruz, coming at you at 101.3 FM. And streaming live at our free stream at freakradio.org, www.freakradio.org. The thing is, I try to make it a point every show, in addition to my duties of reminding you that we are a totally self-sustaining organization in terms of money. That fact, plus the fact that I, for one, desperately desire some feedback from you listeners out there. Please do not presume that you are not a primary listener, whatever the hell that means. Do not assume that because you don't listen that often, or you haven't been listening for a long time, or just because this may be the first time you've ever tuned in, Do not assume that you are not important, that you somehow do not fit in with the fan base, as it were, of Mitty's Migraine. Something led you to this show. If nothing more than the fact that you happen to be flipping through the dial or flipping through your notes and reminded of the existence of this show or of Free Radio Santa Cruz and turned it on and just happened to land here. It's important for the to the foundation of this program that I get a real-time sense of what my real listeners expect to hear on this program or would like to hear from this program or what things you do not like. Now, I've given the phone numbers out several times. I'll give them again in a moment. And another way that you can get in touch with us and with me. I'm poking around in the dark here, not just because I happen to be the only living soul, human soul, in the studio here, not accounting for the various rats and other vermin such as myself, right, who might make their home in this subterranean establishment. Poking around in the dark, coming up with material that I think is important for the subject matter of this program, and subjects and content that I think that I'm hoping you would like to hear, or at least become exposed to. I need some feedback on that. If I don't hear from people, then I will, as I've been doing for a good 2.5 years now, as I indicated, just keep going the way I've been going. This also is highly characteristic of free radio. You got people coming in here who have the itch to be a programmer, to get behind the mic, to be a DJ. And aside from the almost inevitable ego tripping that's involved with that, we provide you with our idea of a radio program. This, obviously, is a show that has a lot of intellectual content, a lot of words, a lot of talking. I'm trying to do at least a little more music, and hoping desperately that it's not too much music, because I don't know. Do you want more readings? Do you want more information? Or do you want more music? I need to hear from you. I will not put you on the air. This is the new rule. I do not automatically put people on the air. They will be able to hear my voice unless I happen to slip off my volume. But I will hear directly from you and find out if you want to go on here. So give us a call. I'll give you the phone numbers again. Area code for both lines is 831. Line 1, 427-3772. 427-3772. Line 2, 469-3119. Line 2 is 469-3119. I don't care if you're in the collective or a former Free Radio Santa Cruz collective member. Call me anyway. I did an interview for another one of our current programmers, and we did get one call in during that interview from a guy who used to be a programmer here. Bless him. Good luck in his ventures. I don't even know what he's doing now, but at least John, who was interviewing me, was able to recognize his voice and his tenor and where he was coming from, to know that he knows the guy, and he used to be on Free Radio himself. I don't care if you have been or have not been. If you're a so-called nobody, and I'm not trying to insult anyone, are you a Gentile, a Jew, a profound atheist or agnostic? I don't care. Any of those things. Any race, creed, or color. And by the way, I do not believe in races. I believe in the human race is the only one that we're concerned with here at this level of activity. The human race includes Israelis and Palestinians. Includes Jews and non-Jews. All right? Now, as for those other ways you can get in touch with me, here is the email address for this program, Mideast Migraines. The Mideast Migraines program on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Here is the address. MideastMadness@gmx.com. That's the old name for the show, Mideast Madness, but the email remains mideastmadness@gorgeousmxxylophone.com. And in this case, we'll spell xylophone with an X as the first letter, .com. mideastmadness@gmx.com. Finally, there is the snail mail address. The post office is, despite what people think of it or how much longer it has to remain in existence, is still around. They still send packages and letters, including your donations, by the way. So if you want to send a communication with or without the donation, or vice versa, if you want to send a donation with or without any additional comments, please send them through the mail, postal mail, to the following address. It goes to Free Radio Santa Cruz, or simply write on the front of the envelope, FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, California, zip code 95061. Santa Cruz, of course, is two words, S-A-N-T-A. Cruz is spelled capital C-R-U-Z. C-R-U-Z. Again, that address for mailing in your money to help us stay on the air and serve you for another 20 years, and another 20 after that, etc. FRSC 7811, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, Calif, period, zip 95061, FRSC, P.O. Box 7811, Santa Cruz, Calif, or just C.A., 95061. We want to hear from you. Don't make the mistake of believing that if you send in money, and I don't even know how this would work in the real physical world, if you send in money during the time that this program, Mideast Migraines, is airing, that doesn't mean that your money is going to go directly to Mideast Migraines. Don't, or more concretely here, more realistically, don't think that if you send us a check or money order and include the note that you were inspired during my call during this particular program to send in your donation, whether you approved of the program or not, do not make the assumption that the money goes directly to support this program. It's strictly a general fund kind of thing. We're way strung out in terms of our finances as it is. We make do with what we can. So you will not be supporting a particular program. In fact, even if you were to ask that the money goes to supporting Mideast Migraines, or likewise, unlikewise, if you were specifically demanded that the money not go to supporting this particular program, it really won't matter. Your sentiments will be noted and perhaps appreciated, perhaps not, but it really goes to the general fund of the whole operation, not just this show. Okay, that is the phone lines, which are open. Snail mail address and email address, mideastmadness@gmx.com. georgemichaelxavier.com. Now, it's 4:20 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Now 4:21. Show goes up until about 4:55. Oh, I need to get these glasses changed. I picked up the wrong focal strength here. This is, I don't know whether I should stand further away or closer to the screen. This can't be good for my eyes. We're going to talk about ISIS. This item is from Cognitive Liberty, specifically the Middle East division of that publication. From Cognitive Liberty, how the U.S., its allies, and Syria unwittingly corporatized ISIS. ISIS standing for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, referred to by some as ISIL, and I believe it has some other names. Many of them overly proud, unduly dedicated members will simply say the Islamic State, IS. How the U.S., its allies, and Syria unwittingly corporatized ISIS, February 7, by Sean Nevins. By Sean Nevins. ISIS operates as both a company and a government that spun totally out of control. The group is selling oil to Assad, President Assad of Syria, and U.S. allies who are also arming them. Arming ISIS. But how did this happen? How did ISIS become the world's wealthiest, most sophisticated terrorist group? Again, from Cognitive Liberty, written by Sean Nevins. Washington. The Islamic State of Iraq and Syria has created an empire that stretches hundreds of miles through the countries of its namesake. It has accumulated riches that enable it to fund a war, govern a population of around 8 million people, and operate massive amounts of infrastructure in the areas it has conquered. During a talk in October at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, David Cohen, the Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence at the U.S. Treasury Department, that's right, the Treasury Department has a sub-department called for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence. Cohen said that ISIS, and I quote, has amassed wealth at an unprecedented pace, and its revenue sources have a different composition from those of any other terrorist organizations. So how did ISIS become the most sophisticated terrorist group in the world, and why is it so rich? This is a very long article, and it's almost 4:30. It will be in a few minutes, and I'm going to dive into this now. How the U.S., its allies in Syria unwittingly corporatized ISIS. The Genesis, Part 1. America's 2003 invasion of Iraq. A lot of history here. Let's go. In 2003, the United States, as part of an effort to transform the politics of the Middle East region, invaded and occupied Saddam Hussein's Iraq. The move was tragic, both for people in the region and in the U.S. It resulted in the violent deaths of almost 150,000 Iraqis and over 4,000 U.S. troops, along with other coalition members. It also created the conditions for Al-Qaeda in Iraq, AQI, to become active. Parenthetically, ironically, then President George W. Bush, Bush 43, Bush the Younger, had forged a connection between Saddam and Al-Qaeda as a pretext to gain American support for the invasion. So he just said in this little paragraph here, Cohen's author Sean Nevins explains that the U.S. invasion of Iraq created the conditions for Al-Qaeda becoming active, initiating. But George W. Bush had forged in the sense of falsely indicated a connection between Saddam and Al-Qaeda as a pretext to gain American support, the support of the American people for the invasion. Let's go on here. AQI, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, later renamed itself the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, ISIS. The origins of ISIS, said Phyllis Bennis, are in fighting against the American occupation. It was one of a number of Sunni Muslim organizations that was fighting against the occupation. There was no question about it. That's what it was, Phyllis Bennis, director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies, a Washington-based think tank, told Mint Press News. She explained that one of the biggest windfalls for militant organizations which resisted the occupation was that the Americans forcibly removed, disbanded, and destroyed the Ba'athist regime, the civil service and military of the former Iraq state. She said that they were, quote, Ba'athist, no doubt, but they are also secular. Ba'athism is a political party and socialist philosophy that was once predominant in both Iraq and Syria. Two separate Ba'athist parties, though, as I recall. She said that they were both Ba'athist, no doubt, but they were also secular. The U.S. inadvertently set Iraq up for division by destroying the secular movement and instituting in its place a sectarian-based political system with new political parties based on the population and correlating numbers of Sunnis, Shiites, and Kurds, Bennis said. Of course, Sunni and Shia refer to the two major sects of the Islamic religion, while Kurds are a specific ethnic group. It perhaps remains to be seen whether most Kurds consider themselves considered being Kurdish with synonymous as one of the two sects or another. On with the article. This political system, which is tearing the country apart and has led to the rise of Sunni extremist militias, is the system the U.S. created, she continued. ISIS was able to emerge so powerfully and quickly, Bennis said, because they had the support of three important constituencies in the country. First, the Sunni generals, who had been stripped of their jobs in the old Iraqi regime and were sent home by the U.S. military with no means to care for their families. Sunni generals were angry and did not appreciate the increasingly sectarian nature, sectarian meaning religious-based nature of the new Iraqi government. Indeed, it has been reported that ISIS is run by a council of former Iraqi generals from Saddam's Ba'ath party. The second group of willing ISIS recruits were Sunni tribal leaders, who were also angry about the sectarian government in Baghdad. Finally, there was the ordinary Sunni population, who were upset by the ethnic cleansing of Baghdad's neighborhoods, arrests, and neglect of key services like electricity. Blowback. Speaking to Mint Press, and I believe Mint Press must be the mother organization of cognitive liberty here. Seems to be the case. Genesis blowback. Speaking to Mint Press, Nafiz Ahmed, author of A User's Guide to the Crisis of Civilization and How to Save It, said that to truly understand how ISIS was formed and remains sustained, it's important to reflect upon the West's past in the Middle East and around the globe. Ahmed said, I think it's important to contextualize everything that's been going on in the region recently with Syria and Iraq in relation to the post-Cold War period in which the United States and Great Britain have continued to flirt with Islamist groups like Al-Qaeda. He was referring to the West's historical role of fomenting Islamist terror groups to pursue its own ends worldwide, and particularly in Iraq. His ideas are outlined in an essay he wrote for Medium magazine, whatever, in September that was immediately reproduced in other online publications, including this one, titled How the West Created the Islamic State. In his essay, Ahmed untangles what seems to be an odious web of relationships stretching back to the 2003 invasion of Iraq. He argues that the current state of disorder in the Middle East is a direct consequence of neoconservative aspirations to dominate regional oil resources, defend an expansionist Israel, and in pursuit of these, redraw the map of the Middle East. Let me read that again so we're all clear on this. Ahmed, in his essay, untangles what seems to be an odious web of relationships stretching back to the original 2003 invasion of Iraq. Ahmed argues that the current state of disorder in the Middle East is a direct consequence of neoconservative aspirations, obviously American neoconservative aspirations too, and I quote him here, dominate regional oil resources, defend an expansionist Israel, and in pursuit of these, redraw the map of the Middle East, end quote. Ahmed's essay illustrates how neoconservatives all the way back in 2002 were advocating for a strategy in the Middle East that would bolster Israel's power by first removing Saddam Hussein. This strategy became known as the Pearl Rand Strategy, named for then chairman of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board, Richard Pearl and Rand Corporation. As a late analyst of the firm, Laurent Mirovitz had introduced it. After removing Saddam, the Pearl Rand strategy draws heavy inspiration from a 1996 Israeli policy document created by the Institute for Advanced Strategic and Political Studies, an Israeli think tank. According to the Israeli policy paper, 1996, with Saddam out of the picture, Israel would ally with Turkey and Jordan to, quote, roll back Syria. Jordan would then solve Lebanon's Shiite problem by, quote, weaning the country away from Syria and Iran to be more dependent on Jordan, thus weakening those two countries. Weakening Syria and weakening Iran. Further, Ahmed explained that Iraq would be divided into three separate states, which would include a Sunni Arab state joined with Jordan and ruled by King Abdullah II of Jordan, a Kurdish state in the north and northwest, and a Shia region in southwestern Iraq, including Basra, would make up the third state, or more likely, it would be joined with Kuwait. Southwestern Iraq, though. I guess that's close to, I keep thinking, you know, Iraq obviously is along the, as a Gulf state, which is more like on the southeastern corner of Iraq. I don't have the map in front of me here, but I think I can see how extreme southwestern Iraq would be adjacent to the country of Kuwait. Okay, end quote, roughly. In his essay, he contends that the, quote, expansion of the Islamic State has provided a pretext for the fundamental contours of this scenario to unfold, with the U.S. and British looking to reestablish a long-term military presence in Iraq in the name of the defense of a young new state. End quote. So, in this guy's essay, he contends in so many words, because he has it in quotations here, expansionist of the Islamic State has provided a pretext for the formation, for the fundamental contours of this scenario to unfold. Continuing now, Bassam Barabandi, a former Syrian diplomat who defected in 2013, expressed contention with this point of view while speaking to MinPress, saying, absolutely, I don't agree with this theory. Barabandi argued that if the Obama administration had wanted to stay in the region, it would not have withdrawn its forces from Iraq. He added that one of Obama's main objectives coming into office in 2008 was to withdraw forces from Iraq. For Obama, he said, the United States economy is number one. They don't need to play all these games. Phyllis Bennis agreed, describing Obama as a, quote, reluctant warrior in the current conflagration in Iraq. She ceded, however, that this does not change much on the ground, despite language coming from the administration that this is solely the fight in Iraq and Syria. She said, the U.S. has emerged once again as the dominant force. There's a building sense of, we're back in the war, she said, Bennis said. While Ahmed's thesis that the West created ISIS comes off as conspiratorial, it is actually more of a warning about neoconservative forces within the U.S. government that had control in the past and would like and could take over in another election cycle. Moreover, Ahmed's essay highlights some important facts about the role of the U.S. in aiding extremist groups in the region. He references an article written by the late Pakistani journalist Syed Salim Shahzad in 2005 about the U.S. sending weapons to Sunni militant groups in Iraq to push back against the Shiite constituency in the south, which was beginning to rally around the idea of instituting Waliyat-e-Faqih, or guardianship of the Islamic jurists, or clerical rule in the country. Ahmed explains in his essay that the U.S. began to arm and fund Sunni groups in Iraq during, quote, the awakening, to fight against increasingly dominant Shiite militias, which wreaked havoc upon the Sunni population. The effects of sectarianism in the country, especially among government policies, persist today and are thought to be among the major reasons Sunnis are joining ISIS. However, the awakening movement, combined with psychological operations by American troops to reinforce and encourage extremist Salafi ideology associated with Al-Qaeda, along with the brutality of some American operations in Iraq, like what happened in Fallujah in 2004, created an environment conducive to the creation of a group like ISIS, Ahmed wrote. Speaking to Min Press, Ahmed said that there is no way to prove, and I quote, decisively that what's happening now in the Middle East is all part of some grand scheme to manipulate the region and do everything that the neocons wanted, end quote. That's not clear, he said. Yet he added that his theory is something people around the world should take note of and consider when thinking about what's going on in the Middle East. Funding, arming, and encouraging Al-Qaeda-linked extremist ideologies was a deliberate U.S. strategy in the region at one point, he said. Meanwhile, his notion that Iraq and Syria are being cut up to facilitate Western imperialist ambitions is being entertained by mainstream media and key strategists in the region. Again, I'm reading from the Mint Press Cognitive Liberty article of February 7, how the United States, its allies in Syria, unwittingly, it says here, corporatized ISIS, by Sean Nevins. Let us continue. The Genesis Part 2, Syria's Civil War. The Syrian Civil War, it claimed the lives of 191,000 people as of August, while more recent reports put the number close to 220,000. An estimated 7.6 million people have been internally displaced, and over 3 million have fled the country as refugees. It is a tragedy of such remarkable proportions that the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, is calling it the biggest humanitarian emergency of our era. The war officially started in March 2011, the Syrian Civil War, after the military and police in the city of Daraa, Syria, ransacked homes in search of a group of about 20 teenagers and arrested them. A growing protest movement emerged, calling for greater political and social freedom. While the majority of the protests were genuine, the government and its supporters insisted that from an early stage, protests were not as peaceful as they looked, according to Patrick Cockburn, author of The Jihadi's Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. Writing for Counterpunch in March, Cockburn asserted, "All revolutions have notoriously devoured their earliest and most humane advocates, but few have done so with the speed and ferocity of Syria's." Evidence of the potential use of arms in the early days of the revolution was reported by Reuters, which quoted from a story from Sana'a, Syria's official news agency, 4 days before the official start of the revolution, dated March 11, 2011. Sana'a reported that security forces in the country had, and I quote, "seized a large shipment of weapons and explosives and night vision goggles in a truck coming from Iraq," end quote. The equipment was reportedly going to be used for, quote, "actions that affect Syria's internal security and spread unrest and chaos," reported Sana'a. Evidence of a radicalized and armed opposition movement in the early months of the uprising came on May 15, 2011, when Ali Hashem, a reporter who was working with Al Jazeera at the time, saw, quote, "men crossing the river from North Lebanon to Syria, precisely in the area called Wadi Khaled in Lebanon." This might be the first documented incident that recorded armed militiamen in Syria. That's a sentence, folks. This might be the first documented incident that recorded armed militiamen entered Syria, or of recorded armed militiamen in Syria, said Hashem, who is now the chief correspondent for Al-Mayadeen TV, a pan-Arabist station based in Lebanon. He said that to Min Press News. Hashem said that he saw, as he put it, tens of fighters at the time armed with unsophisticated weaponry such as Kalashnikovs, assault rifles, RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, and some grenades. Hashem emphasized that at the same time he witnessed these events, peaceful demonstrations were happening in several places throughout the country. At the same time that he witnessed these events, the armed revolutionaries' peaceful demonstrations were happening in several places throughout the country at that same time. In response to these protests, Syrian President Bashar Assad, Assad the Younger, offered cosmetic reforms in an attempt to avert, quote, a full-blown revolt. Rania Abu Zaid wrote for Politico in June, "the new laws lifted the state of emergency and pardoned certain political prisoners at the end of May 2011. Yet rather than being a genuine expression of goodwill towards the thousands of people who were beginning to show up in streets throughout the country, the seemingly liberal decrees were a form of doublespeak for what was to come next. The regime did not just open the door to the prisons and let these extremists out. It facilitated them in their work, in their creation of armed brigades, the National quoted a former security official from Assad's government to say. Former security official from Assad's government. The regime's aim was to create insecurity and radicalize the opposition movement to force the West to make a decision between Assad and religious extremists, either on par with or worse than Al-Qaeda, explained the former official from Syria's military intelligence directorate, whose name was not used to protect his identity. "It was a coordinated affair. From the beginning of the unrest in Syria, Assad claimed that his government was facing a foe of extreme religious bent. Yet this was a foe of Assad's own creation," according to Barabandi, the former Syrian diplomat. Barabandi told Min Press When the revolution transitioned from peaceful to Islamist, it was Sednaya, referencing a political prison close to Damascus, Sednaya, where political prisoners belonging to various groups, such as the Muslim Brotherhood, are held. In 2011, he explained, the regime began to release prisoners, especially ones with a politically extreme and violent understanding of Islam, to radicalize the revolution and create a scenario in which the West would have to choose between Assad or an al-Qaeda-style group. That was the turning point, said Barabandi. Before that, the people in the streets were talking about dignity, peace, and democracy, he explained, noting nobody was talking about Islam or Islamists. In the meantime, pro-democracy protesters were being locked up. Assad, quote, was sure to imprison diverse, nonviolent, and pro-reform activists by the thousands, many of whom are still in government prisons, end quote, Barabandi wrote for the Atlantic Council in July. He continued, these efforts, coupled with relentless barrel bombing, torture, and chemical weapons campaigns, were designed to silence, kill, or display civilians so that the influence of extremists would fill their absence. And my listeners, there's still time to call in. Area code 831 for both these lines. Line 1 is 427-3772. Line 2, 469-3119. Don't forget this program's email address, MideastMadness@gmx.com. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Yeah. Continuing with the article now, several reports support Barabandi's assessment. Quote, most of the important people in these extremist groups were in Sednaya prison. There were many of them, and the regime let them go very deliberately, the national, quotes the former Syrian intelligence officer, is saying. Abu Zaid, an independent journalist who has been covering the region for 15 years, documented that people like Abu Othman, an Islamic scholar for Jabhat al-Nusra, the Nusra Front, were in Sednaya and released under amnesty in 2011. So was Othman's boss, Abu Muhammad al-Golani, who now runs Jabhat al-Nusra since it split from ISIS. Abu Zaid wrote, the extremists were sure that the Assad regime had offered the amnesty, knowing full well that they would take up arms against it. Other prisoners that streamed out of Sednaya prison and then moved on to become prominent members of extremist al-Qaeda-linked groups include Zahran Alush, commander of the Jaish al-Islam, Abdul Rahman Suis of the Liwa al-Haq, and Hawan Aboud of Ahrar al-Sham, and Ahmed Isa al-Sheikh, commander of Sukur al-Sham. In case any of you have come across those names in your in-depth reading there. Continuing, regarding the prison, said Naya Hashim told Min Press, this is another conspiracy theory, but there are several things that can confirm it, because someone like Zahran Alush, who's the military chief of the Islamic Front, was released from the jail in the first months of the revolution, end quote. Many people were released, he continued. Some people even give numbers in the thousands. Maybe this is one of the reasons we are living through this civil war right now. I did say this was a very long article, folks. It demands a lot of attention, I know. Let's just plow through here. We'll be through with the reading in a few minutes, for today anyway. As further evidence of Assad's complicity in the creation of these groups, Abu Zaid wrote, quote, ISIL was headquartered in Raqqa's elegant multi-arch governorate headquarters, hoisting a massive black flag in the square in front of the building. Yet the structure was not targeted in the regime's frequent airstrikes on the city, prompting the Syrian opposition's political leaders to claim that ISIL was a creation of the regime or was colluding with it. There was little direct evidence to suggest either, but one thing was certain: ISIL was playing straight into the Assad narrative that the regime's opponents were extremist Islamists hell-bent on imposing brutal and draconian sectarian rule. A tweet by the New York Times Beirut bureau chief, Anne Baynard, seems to corroborate Abu Zaid's claim that the regime avoids intense confrontation with ISIS. On June 12th, Bernard tweeted the following: a Syrian government advisor told me fighting ISIS is not a priority for government because ISIS is useful in tarring all insurgents and framing choice as Assad slash ISIS. That's hard to read because this is in tweeties here. A former Jordanian military officer corroborated the notion that the rise of extremist Islamist groups was facilitated by the Assad regime. Major General Fayez Dwairi told The National that many, quote, of the people who established Jabhat al-Nusra were captured by the regime in 2008 and were in prison. When the revolution started, they were released on the advice of Syrian intelligence officers who told Assad, they will do a good job for us. There are many disadvantages to letting them out, but there are more advantages because we will convince the world that we are facing Islamic terrorism, end super quote. It is important to note that many of the Ba'athist fighters in Iraq initially became radicalized and joined extremist organizations such as Al-Qaeda in Iraq and ISIS while they were being held in American prisons in Iraq. In fact, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the late leader of ISIS, spent 5 years in Camp Buka, a U.S. military detention facility near Qusar, Iraq. The difference between these two scenarios seems to be one of intention. There aren't any former U.S. Army or intelligence officers stepping forward and saying that the U.S. purposely released Baghdadi and other prisoners to facilitate a civil war. Also, if it is true that Assad has manipulated Sunni extremists to protect his regime, it wouldn't be the first time. A February 2010 cable from the U.S. Embassy in Damascus, and that would be, of course, about a year before the beginning of the Syrian civil war. The cable from the U.S. Embassy in Damascus describes how the Syrian president sent a group of Islamists from Saidnaya prison to Iraq after 2003 to fight the Americans along with the insurgency. That cable, titled When Chickens Come Home to Roost, Syria's Proxy War in Iraq at the Heart of 2008-2009 Saidnaya Prison Riots, describes how a Syrian human rights activist recorded interviews with an inmate from Saidnaya, a prison guard, and three military personnel. She recounts how the government offered, quote, offered Saidnaya inmates the opportunity to receive military training in Syria and then travel to Iraq and fight coalition forces, end quote. Upon their return, some of the inmates remained at large but in contact with the regime. Others went to Lebanon and the rest were arrested again. These were the Islamists. They felt, quote, cheated, the cable says. This led to riots at the prison in the summer of 08, in which 50 to 60 inmates were killed. The prisoners, who were trained fighters, were able to commandeer control of one part of the prison before giving up. During that period, which lasted about 3 months, they traded hostages for food. These are the same people who are now fighting with ISIS and other extremist groups in Syria and Iraq. Okay, we're going to let the rest of the reading go for now. I may indeed not continue, because obviously this is a very thick, rather sleep-inducing article, which tends to confer to the listener that you need to know a lot about recent Syrian and Iraqi history, but it sure does provide a lot of details and does indeed provide much evidence to the fact that those in power, long entrenched power, such as the Assad family and Bashar Assad, the younger Assad in particular, a little dynasty going there for some decades, will do anything to maintain their grip on power. And although I'm not really enthusiastic about referring to this quotation, it's kind of really obvious, a long-standing, often connected strictly to the Middle East saying comes into play here. My enemy's enemy is my friend. Okay, that's all for now, folks. Tune in next Monday for more exciting details about what is really going on out there. See, I can talk about more than Palestine and Israel. I have a little more sense of variety than that. Next Monday at 3 p.m. Also, please join me on Saturday, 11 a.m., 11 in the morning, late morning Pacific time. I'll begin reading Anna Balzer's book, Witness in Palestine. I'm looking forward to it. Join me for a new book reading Saturday at 11, and of course, here next Monday at 3. Ta-ta.